so that constant reattending to the present in search of what other meetings are available, and then being committed to picking the meetings that are consistent with the life that we would ideally like to live is the heart of this mindfulness to meeting theory. And the real quality of life change, the real benefit, doesn't actually come from the mindfulness practice itself. Mm-hmm. It comes from the meanings that arise out of that. But those meanings are only available if someone takes the time to push aside or suspend the dominant interpretation and see what else is available. So mindfulness practice is one way to do that.
Welcome to the Mindspace Podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. The Mindspace Podcast is my personal, in-depth exploration of the science and practice of well-being. I'm sharing this journey with you because I believe we can all lead happier, more meaningful lives by getting the facts and training our minds. Join me as I learn and share the most inspiring insights about human flourishing from leading experts, because we could all use a little more Mindspace. Well, it's been a while since I posted an episode. Sorry for the delay. Of course, I'm in lockdown, and I'm spending much more of my time with my kids than I'm used to, since they're out of school. It's proven to be a really incredible experience, actually, for me and my family, but of course, my productivity has certainly taken a hit. The episode I'm releasing today was recorded before the pandemic, so if you are noticing a conspicuous absence of reference to the pandemic or the lockdown, that's why. Nonetheless, I really feel like the content of today's episode is still incredibly relevant. I interviewed Professor Norman Farb from the University of Toronto. He's best known for his research on the neuroscience of mindfulness meditation. I initially wanted to just pick his brain about the latest in the neuroscience of mindfulness, but we ended up having a much richer conversation about human well-being more broadly. His scientific knowledge and philosophical insight have been an ongoing source of inspiration for me right through the lockdown. We discussed how mindfulness meditation changes our sense of self and how this plays out in the brain, our brain's default mode network and its role in well-being, the importance of balancing routine and creativity, the role of mindfulness in helping us break out of rigid ways of thinking and being, the meaning and relevance of eudaimonic well-being, and how psychedelics fit into all of this. If you find this conversation helpful or interesting, please rate the Mindspace podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and sign up for our newsletter to stay up to date with what we're up to at mindspacewellbeing.com/newsletter. And of course, if you're interested in learning more about mindfulness and psychedelics, please visit mindspacewellbeing.com. And now, here's my conversation with Professor Norman Farb. Norm Farb, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How's the day so far?
Pretty good, yeah. Feel awake, ready to face the week. It's Monday morning as we're recording. So yeah, feeling pretty good about this week so far.
All right, good. So Norm, can you tell us about what you do and how you got to where you are professionally?
Sure. I'm an associate professor of psychology at the University of Toronto at the Mississauga campus, which is like the West Side campus. And I study mental habits that determine our sense of well-being, for better or for worse. On the sunnier side of the street, I study how people improve their mental habits through practices like meditation training, mindfulness training, different therapies, yoga, and now a little bit psychedelics. And then on the cloudier side of the street, I study how mental habits lead to suffering, with a particular focus on depression, relapse, vulnerability, though I've dipped a toe into some research on other mood disorders. And the way I've followed this path has been a sort of winding road from sort of a teenager thinking that they would build a consciousness machine or try to understand, you know, how the mind worked, sort of ill-fated year in computer engineering, dropping out of that and transferring into philosophy and psychology at the University of Waterloo, which just totally by accident, because I went there. French Engineering has a very strong psychology department, and reading a lot of existentialist philosophy and deciding I wanted to be a bit more applied and picking the psychology rather than philosophy side of things as I moved through into graduate training and starting to do neuroimaging to try to understand, you know, what makes up an emotional experience and are all things called, you know, a happier negative emotion, really built to the same stuff. And do those have implications for our well-being? And my chance to learn fMRI was on a funded study to study mindfulness-based stress reduction with my PhD advisor, Adam Anderson and Zindel Siegel, who helped develop mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And I just got fascinated by these sort of very simple training instructions that were really changing the way people's minds were working when they thought about themselves, their emotions. And it became my dissertation topic. And your dissertation topic as an academic is like your brand, and the rest is sort of history. It just got been going further and further down this rabbit hole of understanding how people train themselves on purpose or by accident for wellness or suffering. And my day-to-day life now is teaching undergrads, teaching grad students, and running research studies, and occasionally getting a chance to talk to people on podcasts or public talks or so forth. So I'm just happy to be here.
So lots to discuss, lots to ask you about. I know that the first question is something that you've been talking about for many years now, given that this paper I'm going to reference came out in 2007, and it's probably your most widely read paper, if I know the stats correctly. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's just such an incredibly interesting door you opened looking at these different ways that we think about ourselves, right? The sort of these modes of self-reference, to use your language, mm-hmm. that those two modes tie into two different brain networks, and that mindfulness training is actually differentially cultivating these networks. I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that research.
Sure. Yeah. So as a graduate student sort of getting into this work, I was a total novice to meditation. I had some yoga practice ongoing, but more sort of for fitness. And I was really fascinated by these studies of super long-term meditators, but saw no real way to access that myself as a researcher, and thought, hey, well, why don't I take a stab at what happens when you first start meditating? Because I'm kind of at that precipice myself as well. We were trying to find, you know, a simple story of what's one of the first major effects of meditation. And as someone somewhat naive to the field, or really naive to the fields, I thought, well, it's all about breaking up this self bias to always try to do things in favor of oneself. And that sort of way of thinking was really informed by the fact that when we went into neuroimaging on identity, it was all about this sort of conceptual evaluative self that lets us have properties in our minds that relate to ourselves and other people that are extend over time. And so you have the sense of stability, and you can make commitments to other people and be accountable for your own commitments. And that's well and good, but it also completely filters all of our experience in terms of, well, is this relevant to me? And if not, then I'm probably going to just lose it. We thought that we would just see this self network that's characterized by activation in the sort of midlines of the brain breaking down as people got better at meditating. And the more it broke down, the happier people would be, because they wouldn't be constantly trying to live up to their own internalized ideas of what they were supposed to do or not do. And when we got in the scanner with participants who are completing these 8-week mindfulness courses and ask them to shift out of this, you know, me or not me judgment kind of mode into a more expansive, exploratory sort of sensory mode of being, we did see that there was some ability to reduce activation in the brain in these evaluative or narrative conceptually extended self networks. But it wasn't actually any better, or not much better, I should say, than what you'd see in someone who'd signed up for a mindfulness course who had no experience. And that actually most of the unique sort of training effect, that what people had learned in terms of being able to do something new with their brains, was the ability to more reliably engage in sensory representations. So they were turning down self-evaluation a little bit, but not in any remarkable way. But what was remarkable was the ability to have these kind of self-evaluations and be taking in information from what's happening in their bodies, even in their visual fields, on the surface of the body, the internal body sensations. And you can see this playing out in terms of these sustained activations in sensory parts of the brain. And so we realized at that point that this idea of breaking down the self wasn't really the best way to look at what early mindfulness training was doing. It was more about how you include other sources of information into the self, particularly kind of chaotic or uncontrolled sources of information that are still self-relevant, like sensory information. And that destabilization of one way of knowing about yourself, of holding one sort of laundry list of do's and do nots, or this is the way I am and this is the way I'm not, being having that interfered with by taking in all these disparate sensations from moment to moment, was the core practice for early meditators, to stop really always just knowing what you know and not taking in other information. You wouldn't want to do that if you wanted to learn or change.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I think many beginners think going into an MBSR or an MBCT or something that they're going to get better at quieting their mind or stopping to think or whatever. Mm-hmm. And often what they learn as the programs go on or as people get deeper into meditation is that it's not like you necessarily stop thinking, although that can happen much later as a deeper level of expertise happens. Mm-hmm. But you develop a more spacious awareness where thinking is part of that, as well as these other dimensions of experience, right? Isn't that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, it's exactly so. This sort of conceptual thinking that we in the West have so much formal education training on, even if, mm-hmm. if all you've done is gone through elementary school, everything mm-hmm. is about, you know, building concepts. Mm-hmm. Is only one way of relating to experience. And what we've seen over the past now, you know, decades of research is that the first thing to go when you become stressed or feel overwhelmed is the ability to take in new information, right? And people will tend to really just consolidate and try to just go with what they already know when they're feeling stressed or overwhelmed. And so the ability to still take in ambiguity, to take in new information, is itself a kind of revolutionary act in a way, because you're saying, you know, even if I do feel that I'm under threat, I'm stressed, I don't know if I'm competent to handle what's going on in my life, I'm not going to go into this kind of survival mode. I'm still willing to learn, right? I'm still taking in new information is the initial necessary component for learning. And so I'm not willing to sacrifice that even though I'm stressed. So it's really mm-hmm. taking a stand for letting things still change, as opposed to trying to sort of reactively cling to what we already know about ourselves, like it's something that we can protect or even ought to protect.
Is it too simplistic to talk about specific brain regions that are sort of implicated in the analysis you're making here? So what regions tend to be more activated when we are stuck in a sort of more narrow self-referential or conceptual way of being, and what happens to other brain structures when we open up more channels?
Well, I think anytime we try to reduce something like the brain into, you know, three things, or, you know, even right. a list of things, we're simplifying and when we're always losing some granularity. So it's just a matter of what sort of distinctions are still reasonable approximations for what's going on, and whether they do any, you know, important work for us in terms of helping us understand our own experiences or the experiences of people in general. So, you know, I think there are these pitfalls in neuroimaging, and maybe a decade ago, the pitfall was like, we're going to find the one brain region that does X. And then people started to say, well, no, that's not a very mature way of talking about things. Even if it's useful, you can have this sort of anchor spot. So we're going to talk about now, you know, the brain networks that do X. So we're not going to say it's one region, because, you know, that's not allowed. So we're going to talk about like a set of regions versus another set of regions. But even that is somewhat of a statistical artifact. It's not like parts of the brain activate and other parts of the brain have nothing to do with that. Like everything's connected. But the flip side is if you just say, well, the chemical soup is doing something, it's not very satisfying. So we can at least talk about major distinctions between where metabolism is being allowed to activate it in the brain. And I think that can still give us practical distinctions that resonate with the evidence we get. So even if I didn't want to commit to any one particular brain region, though I do have my favorites as a brain imager, the distinction, for instance, between sensory representation. If you have, 10 units of glucose that you're gonna burn and to let your brain go, like your brain's gasoline is sugar. So if you're gonna use 10 units of glucose, like how many of those get to go into representing new sensory information, and how many of those go into deciding what to do and behavior planning and execution? And if it's 9 of the 10 units are always going into figuring out what to do, you're like someone driving and paying a lot of attention to exactly how the car moves, but like the windshield's completely fogged up and you can't see out the car. And you'd say, maybe you should just, I know you really want to pay attention to controlling the car, but you might want to clean off the windshield a little bit. I think those sorts of distinctions are useful, especially when we realize that there are these big disparities, like all of the activation and response to a stressor is happening in a couple parts of the brain, and other parts of the brain are either not being used at all or actually being suppressed, which is what we see sometimes with emotional stressors. I think those are useful distinctions without getting too caught up in like a 3-millimeter sphere that we think is doing all the work. If we do start to see that there's like a major allocation of metabolic resources like burning glucose in just a few brain regions, start to wonder, well, is that a good thing or not? And so rather than focusing too much on like this is the one 3-millimeter sphere that controls emotion or is where the self is and it should be activated or not be activated, we might wonder, is it adaptive to put so many eggs in one basket, right? To put so much of our metabolic resource into just like figuring out a behavioral response, for instance, or just into some sort of conceptual analysis activity. And so we can make certain broad distinctions with brain areas. And I think the most secure distinction actually is between parts of the brains that only do one thing. So as far as we know, when the sense receptors in our bodies, so eyes, ears, nose, mouth, touch on the skin, feelings inside the body, hit the brain, that receiving point for those signals is very stereotyped. It doesn't also consider a higher order concept or something like that. Like the first thing that happens with vision is it's just trying to figure out like where are edges, right? What colors can we decode from the visual field? Where are they in a sort of 2-dimensional map that eventually becomes a 3-dimensional map? So we can really know that if there's energy being consumed in those parts of the brain, that it's probably has something to do that's very closely allied to that sense modality. And conversely, if we have a lot of activation in the front of the brain to the detriment or exclusion of some of these sensory areas, we know that this is a lot more a process of association, analysis, and planning responses. So I think at that level, even though the story is going to continue to evolve and mature, we can talk about brain dynamics in a meaningful way. And what we're trying to steer clear from is sort of reifying, right? Saying that this one brain region, or even this cluster of brain regions is just doing one thing, but by contrasting brain regions, especially mm-hmm. regions where we have a very clear idea of what they're doing to other regions, we can hopefully come up with sensible and replicable accounts of what's happening in a given context. I don't think it's that useful to focus just on one region, but if we see a really major shift in how the brain is working, then that's worth talking about and might have some practical implications.
I'm afraid I might be sort of risking not taking up your recommendations just there, but when I read your papers and I, read the regions of the brain that you're studying, mm-hmm. it does sound to me like you're playing around with the default mode network, which I'm willing to bet that this is sort of like a overly, again, reified or very sexy network these days. Is it fair to say that some of the things you're talking about here involve the default mode network when we're talking about modes of self-reference?
Yeah, I think the default Mode Network. I think all these networks are like the current state of the game, and they probably are to some degree statistical artifacts because, as I was trying to say before, no one network is really operating in exclusion to others. And yet, some parts of the brain have activation profiles where they tend to activate with a few friends around other parts mm-hmm. of the brain at the same time, and that's where you start getting some of these network accounts. And just from my own, you know, direct experience doing imaging studies, if you see certain brain dynamics show up across different contexts that suggest like a sort of meta function of some of these brain networks. So in the case of the default network, if you have someone do a new task where they have to pay a lot of attention, almost invariably, unless that task is about self-reference or thinking about the minds of others or something very specific, almost invariably the default network will actually turn off. It will become suppressed when they first start doing a new task. And you see a lot of these sort of executive function, motor planning regions, attending to what's going on right now, sort of prefrontal regions activating when someone first starts doing a new task, even if it's a trivial task, like press with your index finger. If you see a left arrow, use your middle finger on your right hand, at least for a right arrow. So just press the direction the arrow is going. For the first 20 seconds, the default network turns off and you see these other parts of the brain turn on as the person tries to make sure that they're implementing the instructions correctly. And then as they get confident in doing a task that is relatively trivial, like press left when you see left, press right when you see right, those regions actually start to shut off and the default network comes on. And it really supports this idea that what the default network is helping us do is consolidate effortful, intensive tasks of like really paying attention and figuring out what to do into a form of habits. So when I'm in this context, I'm going to link this context with this profile of perceiving and behaving. And then I don't have to spend all this time and energy worrying about it. Hmm. And so from that perspective, yeah, a lot of what we do does sort of get interpreted in terms of these networks where when people are doing things that they have done many times before, right, that are sort of habitual ways of knowing or habitual ways of responding, we would expect to see the default network activated. And if you really want to tap directly into that network, you should ask people to tap into that type of information. So like, does this word describe you or not, is asking people like, what do you already strongly know mm-hmm. about yourself as a comparator to, you know, a trait word on a screen, and then you get the default network firing mm-hmm. or what is this person thinking? You get the default network firing because you have to tap into, there's nowhere else to get this information. It only comes from what you've already internalized.
So the default mode network, when it is described as a network, associated with self-referential thinking, that is the case insofar as self-referential thinking is very habitual and consolidated way of paying attention or dealing with the world. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. And any other habit that you're relying on would probably also start to activate this network. So it's not exclusive to that. But in the context of self-reference, if you're comparing different forms of self-reference, for instance, this default network would be that habitual way of knowing. That's why we sort of cast it as this sort of like a narrative, because narrative is like, you know, a story mm-hmm. you tell, and you might have variations on a theme, but there's still a heart to that story that's consistent. And you can see other research actually now on people listening explicitly to narratives, not even necessarily about themselves, where you get a lot of these same hubs of the default network playing an important part in the encoding of that narrative.
So if you disrupt the default mode, which as far as I understand tends to happen when people meditate, and almost on a baseline level when people are meditating regularly, mm-hmm. what you're disrupting is habitual ways of relating to experience. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's how we've tried to characterize it. Yeah.
Huh. Interesting, and very relevant to the whole set of implications or benefits of practicing meditation and psychedelics for that matter, as we'll get into later, because mm-hmm. there's some cool, as far as I understand, data showing that psychedelics affect the default mode network as well. So maybe we'll just park that one for now.
Okay.
Come back to it.
Sure.
So you have a meditation practice. Is it possible for you to describe the conscious experience of these different modes of self-reference and these different patterns of activation in the brain? Like, do you know what it's like to be in a
narrative mode, or do you know what it's like to be in an experiential mode in terms of your own subjective experience?
Well, I haven't cross-referenced my subjective experience against scanner states, though people have done studies sort of on like when you notice your mind wandering, what happens in the brain, for instance. But what it's like, I think when you have the feeling of like a context, like something's going on in the background, and it lends itself to sort of a familiar train of thought, that's for me what I would ascribe to the default network running. So I start seeing, let's say I'm walking down the street and I start seeing people as obstacles. and so what's happening is in the background, I'm holding the context of like, I'm in a rush, I need to get somewhere. And that's the default network sort of running. And at the same time, if I'm walking down the street and I see people as like, oh, other humans, you know, we can all be connected. Isn't it great? We're all on the planet. That's still the default network running. So it's hard to point to like I wouldn't point to any one particular type of content as a default network. But once you get it aware of that you're thinking in a certain style, like I'm doing the thing where I beat myself up again, or I'm doing the thing where I try to figure out what I should have said in that meeting, or I'm doing the thing where I'm really hopeful about the future, because people often conflate default network with negative. It doesn't have to be. And sometimes you hear this with sort of like born again meditators, like, well, now I found the truth. And you're like, well, you've just you've loaded different content into your default network. So, so whenever things come sort of like preloaded and they follow what can with observation become a familiar sort of pattern of topics, or train of thinking, that's a default network helping to curate experience. And I would say to distinguish that from other networks sort of rising up, when you have that moment of like, what's going on? That was surprising. I didn't expect that. So, you know, emotions like awe, right? When you're like, you realize that that your experience sort of transcends what you expected from the situation you're in, that there's something bigger than what the context you're already holding, some degree surprise, realizing you've made like a kind of mistake and you have to reevaluate things. Those sorts of feelings of like, I need, something has to change, right? That feeling of like something either has changed or something needs to change because of information I'm taking in. That's the feeling of almost like the suction cups coming off of the default network and shifting into a more exploratory sort of sensory intake, or could be a sort of cognitive deliberation kind of mode, which we know occupy different real estate in the brain. And as soon as you relax back into like what's familiar, it's the default network spinning back up. So I think there really is a feeling to that. And even within a given meditation practice, if you've been meditating for a while, for me, at least, there were sort of familiar litanies, right? Things I would say like, oh, this is the part where I worry about like why my back is hurting again, right? Or this is the part where I wonder about what I'm doing here and whether it's working, or this is the part where I think I'm getting it. and I start being like, these are just different stories I tell myself when I'm stuck there sitting. Right. And other times I'm just absorbed in what's going on in a sensory way, and I'm not trying to fit it into a narrative or a way of understanding a situation that's like other things that's happened to me before. And then that sort of feeling of like timelessness, because you're just sort of taking things in, or playing, right? Like, what if I'm playing with, when I move my attention, I feel like sparks moving down my arm or something like that. Like, and I just don't really know what's going to happen. I would think those are very distinct from these kind of default network dominated experiences, because you really just don't know. That's that feeling of ambiguity, and it can be scary, but also make you curious. Those are sort of high energy states that are sort of the opposite of what the default network wants to do, which is sort of consolidate our experiences into something predictable and reliable.
I love this metaphor of like the suction cup coming off.
Yeah.
I guess I really feel that. I think I resonated with this sense of like awe or surprise, being more creative. Is it pushing it to say that the suction cup coming off is a state of mindfulness?
I think the moment right after we're surprised, or you have that moment of awe, what we're sort of designed to do is be mindful of what's going on, right now. And, I think in the absence of already knowing what's happening, there's a chance to have a really rich experience or deeper experience of what's going on in the present. I still haven't totally worked out for myself. Maybe we'll never. To what extent that you can make the default state a kind of mindful state? They seem a little bit contradictory. Like, can I have a already set up way of knowing that's about mm-hmm. being tied to not knowing? It's very paradoxical, which maybe makes it, maybe that does actually makes it right for a lot of right. the traditional teachings. So how do you create a habit of discarding your habits? Mm-hmm. I think is, it's a really sort of interesting project. This idea of things having sort of a richness, having an urgency, or at least a mystery to them in the moment, is something that would fit with the kind of suction cups coming off. And the caveat I usually give when I give a talk or something is you don't want to walk around with no suction cups. Well, I haven't used right. suction cups as much, but you know, you don't want to walk around with no habits. You don't want to forget what a red light means at an intersection. You don't want to forget who your family members are, that you might relate to them differently than, you know, a stranger on the street, even though from a very elevated philosophical perspective, of you might want to get to, you might idealize, I want to treat everyone equally and make no differences between people. Practically, that's not going to work for working in the world, right? I can't embrace everyone as though they're my mom the first time, even though, because you know, hugs aren't always appropriate. So you know, you kind of have to balance these sorts of considerations, like not valorize breaking down the default network too much, even though in early practice, and indeed as an upkeep throughout our lives, we do want to curate the habits that we're forming and prune the ones that aren't particularly adaptive or consistent with our values.
So I just came back from a 7-day silent meditation retreat at IMS, and I was doing a lot of meditation and feeling much of the time like really up against the flow of sort of unfolding experience in this very open and awe-inspired way. Mm-hmm. And then I got back and, you know, have a busy life. I have two little kids at home and a job and whatnot. And I sort of had this for the first few days, this like really intense aversive experience of all of these patterns and all of these entanglements sort of creeping back up on me to the point where like the sense of self that I had on retreat felt like it was being gobbled up by the sense of self that is built into my environment and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I'm very sensitive to the need for routine, the need for habits and stuff. But I think, as you mentioned off the top, there's something incredibly liberating or happiness inducing about having that freedom. Mm-hmm. And so I guess a long answer to a question here about, okay, we got to find a balance between relying on habits that are working, but also having space for creative engagement with things. What, in your view, both as a practitioner and as a scientist, are the most efficient ways to cultivate that freedom in the event that the routines and habits are taking up too much space?
Yeah, it's a lifelong question, I think. And I've had a similar experience, I imagine, to what you're saying of coming back off a retreat and just feeling like totally overwhelmed with all of these, like, you know, just demands to be different ways that seem yeah. like just exhausting. I personally am not too much of a purist where I think, oh, you just have to do this one practice or it has to be this kind of formal meditation. I think, where our dogmatism or where it's worth fighting for is knowing sort of what you stand for in the world in a more abstract sense. So I really like thinking about, you know, values or virtues that we would like to cultivate and having that be the kind of fixed point in the way it sort of gets expressed or the way we get it to be expressed is something that we can experiment with and be creative. And so for me, this sort of negotiation between habits and being open and exploratory and tearing down habits is curated by having like what I'm trying to be mindful of is actually the values that I want to prioritize for myself. So it might just be like one thing, like you know, kindness or compassion or empathy for the day, something I want to work on. And then trying to be very clear what that is. And I think of, and then trying to see what's getting in the way, what's a barrier for the expressing that value and where is it working? And if I'm trying to get myself to be a certain way or change the way I'm being, what's working and what's not. And if it's not working, try something different. I guess what I would say is, I think that's something that's not explicitly modeled in a lot of mindfulness training yet. It's a kind of confronting question, like, you know, what are you up to in your life? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like the most important question. My limited reading of the traditional practices is that people would spend, if you were, you know, a monastic, you might spend 10, 20 years studying and internalizing that value system before meditation was seen as being particularly useful. And we kind of upended things here and said, well, we have so much garbage built into our brains that the first thing we should do is get into these sort of practices that destabilize what we already know, because it's so much already that there's no room for virtue. You know, it kind of both need to be true. And I have a kind of gardening metaphor in my mind, right? That you want to be able to prune out weeds and get rid of plants that are, you know, maybe toxic or causing allergies or things like that, or you just don't, they're not your vision for your garden. But you can't just be pruning all the time, right? You can't just be pulling stuff out of the ground, or else you're going to be left with a dirt patch. And at some point you have to decide, like, here's what I want to grow. And that creates its own challenges. So maybe it's not growing well, and you think, oh, maybe I'm not the kind of person who can grow things, right? So, or you could say, well, maybe I should try again, or maybe I have to germinate the seeds in a particular environment that's more protected, right? So maybe I have to practice something like, let's say, compassion for others in a formal meditation before I try to do it in a charged work environment. But what I'd be clear on is like, but I am trying to grow these kinds of plants, right? I am trying to cultivate compassion. I am trying to cultivate an ability to hold my anger or whatever the issue is for me in that period of time. And if I can be dogmatic about that intention without knowing how it's going to play out, then I can try different things. I could stick a post-it note on my mirror. I could do a formal meditation practice. I could go get some exercise if I'm really stressed, so I won't inadvertently snap and harm people around me. That part, I think, is sort of a choose your own adventure. It's like the biggest thing that's important is keep trying to develop, keep trying to grow, and just be real with yourself. Is what am I doing working or not? Right. So that's been my approach, and I really have been trying to cobble everything I can together possibly to make what happens in my real life consonant with the values I have. And the formal meditation has been a part of it, but a lot of it is also like, when I feel the cold bathroom tiles on my feet, I'll remember to be kind to my children, even if they're not listening to me in the morning. Right. And like, so it becomes like a Pavlovian conditioning, almost like you feel the tile on your feet, you remember to set the intention, like to be kind to getting the kids to school, because otherwise what will happen is like they're barriers to you getting your day started. And then there's going to be resentment, and you're going to end up expressing myself in a way that is not, doesn't fit with my intentions. So how do I remind myself when I'm kind of sleepy and cranky in the morning too, to do those things? Well, my formal meditation practice like the night before doesn't help me do that, right? It maybe it does in some indirect way, but like a quick reminder or like something like that really does. And then maybe adding on to that, so then despite my best intentions, I'm still getting annoyed. So then in the moment, can I have a plan for what I'm going to do when we're falling behind? Can we get up 10 minutes earlier if I'm still using the example of getting my kids ready? Can I find a way to push them to get ready faster that's not viewed by them as aggressive? Like, can I tickle them instead, which is still aggressive, but it's like nice aggression, or as opposed to yelling at them, right? So, you know, it becomes, you just sort of cobble together whatever I need to sort of make it work. And eventually that becomes, if it's working and I start doing repeatedly, that becomes the new habit. And then I can move on and focus on changing something else.
I am definitely going to pay attention to my feet on the cold towels in the bathroom in the morning. That is a great idea. And I really need some help on that one. So thanks for that.
Yeah.
This is a, to me, a really nice opportunity to talk about something that has been really influential to me, and I'm very glad to have a chance to talk to you about it. It's this model that you developed with a colleague, Eric Garland, this whole mindfulness to meaning approach. I find it, first of all, incredibly useful to think about eudaimonic well-being. And maybe you can just speak about, you know, what eudaimonic well-being is and how this model of mindfulness to meaning is a nice way to think about how mindfulness can help us cultivate well-being. I find it especially interesting, again, in the context of what we're talking about here, we're not ultimately striving to be in this non-judgmental, exploratory, or awe-inspired state all the time, mm-hmm. Because we need to be functional and we need to be living pragmatically in the world. But that mindful awareness is an opportunity to step out more momentarily and make adjustments on the path towards greater and greater levels of well-being or managing adversity in useful ways. Can you describe the model? I'm sure you'll do a better job than me.
Yeah. So Eric, I met at Mind and Life Summer Research Institute, which is sort of like a contemplative summer camp week that the Mind and Life Institute runs in the US. He's an independent researcher. We kind of hit it off, and he's really the one who led this theory, and I sort of gave my two cents in it. But I'm a proponent of testing this idea that the reason why mindfulness is effective is because over the long term it does change the sort of bedrock or foundational interpretations and meanings we have about the world and ourselves in the future, which, you know, from clinical psychology are the foundations for our sense of well-being. Eric comes from a social work training background where he would be doing counseling on patients in the faces of getting these devastating diagnoses, like you get a cancer diagnosis and all of a sudden the next 30 years of planning and expectations for how life is going to goes out the window. And so, of course, there's a lot of negative emotion that happens there. But what he was seeing, especially with clients as they practice some of these contemplative techniques, and not just, meditation techniques, but also sort of more, secular Western therapeutic techniques, was that there's what people are really trying to do is reconfigure that sense of meanings and really figure out like, well, if I only have a year left to live, what matters? And what we know from more general psychology is that like throughout almost all of our lives, we have this tuning towards negative things. Like we have a preferential bias to pay attention to and encode negative things, except for very late in life when we know our time is limited. And then the bias shifts towards taking in and attending and remembering and dealing with positive information. This is work that's by Laura Carstensen that's been around for a few decades now, actually. And really interesting, if you get younger people who have terminal diagnoses, they show the same flip of biases. And now all of a sudden, mm-hmm. now they're much more focused on the positives in life. And from an evolutionary perspective, we want to be able to tune in more to negative things than positive things, because the negative things could kill us, right? If you don't notice a predator or a cliff face or something when you're wandering around in the jungle, there's nothing else to notice after that because life is over. But in the contemporary age, there are not that many moments that were really at a sort of life or death situation, and yet we still walk around watching for tigers and spiders and cliffs and or proverbially in the workplace. But it doesn't have to be that way, because we know that when people don't expect to live that much longer, that these biases are malleable. Rather than just think about mindfulness as like a really short-term relief, which it can be, right? Like you can learn to just breathe slowly and focus on your breath and have a physiological relaxation response and take some of the load off of these sort of habitual stressors that we ruminate about, which has a short-term benefit. But over the long term, if we really want to talk about meaningful change, this process of reattending to our experience affords us different interpretations. And that can be a different interpretation around like the sensation of my toe, but it could also be a different interpretation around like who I am as a person or like what the future is going to be like in the world. And if we are exploratory and returning again and again with our attention to the same stimulus, like who am I as a person, for instance, then just all kinds of different interpretations will come up, right? Some of them will be nonsensical. Some of them will be really positive. Some will be really negative. If that's curated in a way with some sort of intentionality, like I do have certain values I care about, or I do have something I'm up to in the world and I realize my time is limited, then returning back to those kind of core concepts will let us renegotiate the story we tell by default, right? We can start leaning a bit more into and endorsing interpretations that fit more with the story we'd like to tell, as instead of just inheriting the story that we've already been telling. Mm-hmm. And so the mindfulness to meaning theory is really the story about that process, right? That mm-hmm. if you keep coming back to the same thing over and over again, and you're open to it, like you're exploring it, you're just going to just, if it's just, even if it was just like noise bouncing back to you every time you reattend, and it's sort of arbitrary what bounces back each time, you'll notice that there are certain responses you have to thinking about the self, for instance, that seem like kind of chronic. And then you might also notice, if you're really paying attention to doing it over and over again, that there are actually 9 other interpretations that show up sometimes. They're just not dominant, they're available. So you're not just making it up. You're like, no, this is something else I actually could believe about myself. It's hard to hold that in place while I also have this other major mm-hmm. Negative interpretation about myself for the future, my ability to relate to my family or other people or be successful in the world or whatever it is that the story you're telling. And then the question becomes like, so if you have other interpretations that are available that are just there for you, but you've just learned to focus on one and it's actually making you miserable or counterproductive or destructive in your relationships or whatever it is, why not try to nudge yourself a bit more towards attending to the interpretations that are empowering and value consistent? And part of why we don't do that is it takes effort, right? It's much easier just to know what we already know. And sometimes it takes a kind of wake up call, like knowing that you have a life sentence, like a terminal diagnosis. Like I only have a year to do all these other things that I've been putting off because they're not the priority interpretation of what my life's about. But we don't have to wait for that, right? That's why it can be like a bit revolutionary. Instead of just like waiting for something external to shake us up, we can be that brings salience to or motivational importance to the need to figure it out right now. So that constant reattending to the present in search of what other meanings are available, and then being committed to picking the meanings that are consistent with the life that we would ideally like to live is the heart of this mindfulness to meaning theory. And critical about it is what we're arguing is like the real quality of life change, the real benefit doesn't actually come from the mindfulness practice itself. Mm-hmm. It comes from the meanings that arise out of that. But those meanings are only available if someone takes the time to push aside or suspend the dominant interpretation and see what else is available. So mindfulness practice is one way to do that.
And isn't it the case that there's many, many pressures to always come back to the familiar framing or the familiar interpretation of stressors or whatever experience is happening? Just as we talked about earlier about, just relying on habits and routines for the efficiency of it, perhaps an evolutionarily baked in negativity bias. And that just gets exacerbated by stress or negative affect or low mood, right? And this is where people who experience depression can get really stuck. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if this is a nice opportunity to talk about some of the mechanisms of mindfulness in terms of helping with mood that you've explored in more recent research. Just the idea that decentering, which I think is a nice way to summarize what's happening when someone's able to step out of a familiar or rigid way of seeing a situation or a stressor and be open to new interpretations, that turns out to be an extremely important part of what makes the mindfulness interventions effective, right?
Yeah, completely. And I think I've sort of been touching on this, if not saying it directly already, is it's this ability to notice what's already running us by default, if we're going to keep using the default mode network language, that is a critical first step to any sort of real change, like real change at the level of like personality or deep meaning making or sense of well-being in the world. That it is almost sort of obligatory that we're going to have these sort of interpretive habits. Like it's just too metabolically expensive not to already know, not to already know things. Like, it just doesn't work to not know things at all about the world. Right. So yeah, there is this pressure. And in something like depression, there's just so much evidence that's been carefully accrued and cultivated around like the hopelessness and inefficacy of a person's inability to cope in the world. That can be really difficult to overcome and form these sort of downward spirals where attention just gets more and more narrow in finding confirmatory information around that sort of helps perpetuate and justify the life story. And so, the research we've done, and this is all work that's sort of been led by my colleague Zindel Siegel, who helped develop mindfulness-based cognitive therapy on understanding depression relapse vulnerability, looks at what is happening in the minds of people who have depressive symptoms or a history of depressive episodes that distinguishes them from other people, and also what predicts what's going on in the minds of these people when they come out of episodes, when they recover from a depressive episode, what's happening when they get stressed that predicts who among a group of people with a history of depression will relapse again in the near future versus those who found a way to become resilient in some way. The story I tell is that the data has been showing myself and my colleagues is one of sensory suppression in the face of stress, a sort of doubling down on what's already known. So a sort of default mode network activation becoming dominant and sensory intake being inhibited. And we've now seen this in a few different samples. We're still publishing on the most recent cohort of around 85 people with history of recurrent depression with a two-year follow-up after we scan them to see who becomes depressed again or not. And when you show people things like sad film clips in the scanner to put them in a sad mood, even if, almost everyone in the scanner feels sad, that you get them to like a 4 out of 7 or a 5 out of 7 on a sadness scale, their brains look really different. When you sort of compare individuals who end up relapsing again in depression or those who don't, or you compare individuals who have high depression symptom scores at the time of the scans compared to those who have lower scores, compare people who have mindfulness training compared to those who don't, in that there's much more sensory suppression in the face of these emotional challenges that both predict higher concurrent depression scores, that people will be more actively depressed when they're in the scanner, and they also predicts who will relapse again into depression in the past, even though you're scanning them at a time when they're remitted. So there's something really profound about not losing track of the bad feelings when you're sad. Like, it's again kind of paradoxical. It makes sense that if you could just go jump into a story, and it, in some ways, even though it's an unpleasant story about, oh, this reminds me of all these other negative events I've had, it's a familiar story, and you don't have to deal with the intensity and the ambiguity of feeling sad in your body in the moment. There's a kind of something seductive about that sort of attentional act to just sort of double down into the habitual narrative, but the narrative can be persisted for as long as you're drawing breath. So even though that negative feeling state might be more intensely negative than the narrative is, the negative feeling state, because it's just a feeling state, it's just represented in terms of its sensory qualities in the body, at least at one level, that feeling state cannot last that long. Like, even if you have a strong stress response in your body and all this cortisol, like in these protective, hormones are being, stress hormones are being released in the body, your body will clear that same release of cortisol within about an hour and a half. But you can keep telling the story about how your mom didn't love you, right, for every day of your life, right? So, and then the body just releases more cortisol and has to clear it. And then you get stuck in this sort of inflammatory cycle. And so what we've sort of put forward, and this is, of course, our bias as people who've been trained under very cognitive models of depression. I'm sure there's genetic and situational factors, but the part that we can control in terms of our own minds is if we can stop just telling this story over and over again over time and allow ourselves to sit with maybe the more intense unpleasantness of just feeling bad in the moment, that bad feeling will pass much more quickly than the narrative ever will. And you can see this in people even without mindfulness training. For instance, we had a pilot study where we had people watch sad film clips in the study in the scanner. And the people who didn't relapse in this group of people who all had a history of past depressive episodes are the ones who were really just using their visual cortex. Like they were really just watching the film clips and not thinking about it too much as they watched, you know, these sad scenes of like, a parent saying goodbye to their kids because they have a terminal illness in terms of endearment or something like that. And the people who are really just watching the movie, like their brains look like it's just a lot of visual cortex activation and they're not diving way into the default network, even though there's a lot of that activation for everyone. It's not an exclusive activation. They're also still showing a lot of sensory activation. They're the ones who stayed well and they would show higher, you know, acceptance scores. If we're starting to get at this idea of what are the underlying capacities, like they're more able to just be with the negative sensation. Another way acceptance is talked about in the clinical literature is distress tolerance. Mm-hmm. And that also correlates with, as you were mentioning, decentering scores, the ability to just sort of be aware of and notice experience arising and passing in the mind rather than being completely subsumed and sort of lost in it. So they're the people who stay well, and the people who are activating more sort of the frontal parts of their brain, part hubs of the default networks, trying to figure out what to do. Like I have to solve this problem that I'm seeing something sad right now. I have to relate it to other experiences to figure out what the right course of action is. Like the emotion itself is a problem to be solved that requires our habitual knowledge to solve it. Those are the people who actually showed much higher levels of depressive rumination, like the inability to get out of their own minds about their negative stories, which is sort of what depressive rumination is. And they're the ones who relapsed again. And now we've seen this again in a much larger cohort of around 150 people, where we scanned about 80 of them, about half the group. And we've published on the self-report side of it, and we're getting ready to publish the imaging side of it, which again shows this sort of sensory suppression pattern. But on the self-report side, where people are filling out questionnaires, it is the people who are saying that they're able to decenter, like, or diffuse their cognition from sort of these, like, their momentary cognition from broader interpretations. They can see thoughts playing out in real time rather than just seeing them as sort of longstanding truths. So you can have the same thought, like I'm worthless or I'm a failure. And it's one thing to see that yourself, you can just have the thought I'm a failure and that be the truth versus see yourself thinking I'm a failure. Like I just had the thought I'm a failure. So to be more than what the content of one's thoughts, the endorsement of that, which we've called decentering, or sometimes it's called metacognitive awareness, like the ability to be aware of the workings of your own mind, that capacity seems to be really protective against depressive relapse. Mm. And one thing that's quite interesting in the context of doing something like a mindfulness course, like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, but even doing just a non-mindfulness type of training, like just a wellness-oriented cognitive therapy, which is a very conceptual way of thinking about how to change your mental habits and less about experiential sort of sensing. It doesn't really matter what the intervention is. It's the growth in this capacity to decenter, to be curious and explore and notice the habits of your own mind that's more protective. It's not really about getting rid of bad feelings or getting rid of like residual symptoms or something like that that you have from a past bad experience. In some ways you're kind of stuck with that. That's the product of your past. And the thing that you can really change is this ability to know what's happening in your own mind. Mm. And it's the growth in that decentering ability. That's the predictor of whether or not someone will relapse or not.
So someone who's already quite strong in decentering, if there's not much room for them to grow, they won't be depressed in the first place. You're talking about a change score of some kind.
Yeah, exactly. So if someone's really, really high in decentering and they enter the study, they probably aren't going to continue to grow. They also probably aren't going to relapse. They probably didn't need to do a mindfulness course, right? Because they already had the kind of one of the capacities, at least, that is a focal target of the mindfulness intervention, which is like get familiarity with what's happening in your own mind. So it's not that I'm not saying that if you're blessed with really high decentering already, you probably also aren't going to relapse as easily. Mm-hmm. But if you're someone who's really at risk, someone who it starts with even sort of a normal amount of decentering, but the burden of a history of depressive episodes, and then you show no growth. You don't get worse, but you show no growth. You're mm-hmm. at maybe 20% higher risk of relapse than someone who does start to show that growth pattern. Mm. But I think what's really kind of cool is a lot of this growth that creates this change score happens after the 8-week courses are over, right? So you get this initial bump when you're in the courses, of course, because you're supported and you're learning all these things. You're probably practicing more studiously, more with higher, you know, adherence to your practice intentions when you know someone's going to be checking on you every week. So you get this bump, but then you have over the next 2 years, a growth that's at least as big as you get the bump you get in the 8 weeks. It just spread out over 2 years. And that's predicted by whether people internalize and continue to practice on their own. And so what we end up seeing is, like, we're starting to come around to this position now that it's the growth in these capacities, like to have acceptance or tolerance for negative events, and also to have this curiosity that leads to insights about the workings of your own mind that you call decentering. So sort of decentering and acceptance or equanimity. It's the growth in these capacities that people can be empowered to change. And that's really what that's really how a practice should be evaluated, at least in the context of understanding whether it's going to be protective against something like depression. So you're meditating every day. It's great that you're practicing a lot, but just practice quantity doesn't actually predict whether or not someone's going to relapse or not. Practice quantity only predicts whether someone's going to relapse to the extent that practice helps to cultivate these capacities like decentering and distress tolerance or acceptance. Right.
That's cool. So we develop the capacity to decenter, to open up other channels and get unstuck from these habitual, sometimes depressive or negative ways of appraising situations. Mm-hmm. Then we also have to develop some clarity on what direction we want to go in, the values and the intentions going forward, so that we decenter and then re-engage with something meaningful and hopefully, you know, workable or well-being enhancing. And then this is sort of like progressive approximations of getting that right and decentering again and reconnecting with the value. All of this is meant to serve in the cultivation of eudaimonic well-being, right? Can you just describe what that is?
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. That was part of, I think, your earlier question too, is the goal is to have a life where the value in the life is sort of this comes from stable, positive meanings that what you're doing is worthwhile. And so eudaimonic well-being is often defined relative to hedonic well-being, right? So whereas hedonic well-being is just having that sort of moment of pleasure, you know, the taste of sugar, like the excitement of a new romantic fling or something like that. Eudaimonic well-being is well-being that's sort of a consistent feeling of contributing to something that creates long-standing value, right, or meaning. And so the idea is that we all have certain things that are programmed into us, maybe at a genetic level, maybe in early development, maybe because of like conscious life choices and reasoning we've made for ourselves that we see as being like the right way to live a life, like what makes a good life. And the problem is that most of our interactions in the world aren't about that, right? It's about like getting our attention to sell us something or making us behave a certain way in work or at home, or do something for someone else. And so the opportunities that we have to consciously pursue the things that we actually believe make life most meaningful are often lost to us. Like our reward centers are sort of hijacked to get by hedonics, right? So advertising, like we in the contemporary age is a great example of this. It's always about giving us something that's immediately rewarding, like put an attractive person on a screen so your attention will be occupied on what's on the screen so we can slip in some other messaging. And all of that comes at the expense of thinking about these deeper, more meaningful things. And while everyone is different in terms of what their exact values are, there are a lot of different theories that talk about where we have sort of common, maybe good guesses as to what those values would be, sort of like, being respected and connected to other people, right? So a relatedness value or feeling like we have some sort of autonomy that we're able to sort of choose for ourselves and have some freedom to make our own decisions, or having a sense of efficacy that we're good at something, right? We're not good for nothing. Even at the broad level, you know, these are the types of, to make it more, a bit more concrete, these are the types of things that would be considered more like eudaimonic values, as opposed to like visceral pleasure or thrill, or like that adrenaline rush. Being able to, as I think you really eloquently summarized, to continually return and investigate our experience and see whether we're doing that or not, is like one, like a capital P, like project, right? It's like, that is the project. Mm-hmm. And how do we get the skills to continually check back in, notice what the habits are, to remember, to compare them to some sort of idea of values, even if it's not that explicitly stated, like, does this feel right to me or not? It's an ongoing practice. And one really nice thing about, you know, a skilled psychotherapeutic practice or a mindfulness practice is it also normalizes failure, right? We are going to get, our attention is going to get captured by something else. We are going to make mistakes. We are going to hurt people. We are going to do things where we present ourselves or create exactly the opposite of what we wanted. And how do we, what is there to do then, right? Like, and how do we continue to just try to maximize these virtues?
It's an interesting comment you just made there, in the sense that we might add to mindfulness and meaning the how essential it is to bring kindness and compassion to the equation, because we're human beings. And it's easy to sort of think about this as a kind of algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. Where you screw up, you try again, but it's very painful sometimes how frequently we can make the same mistake or fall in the same appraisal or just be flawed. And it really does seem like kindness and compassion are the fuel that are required to stay engaged with the project.
I think a lot of the evidence at this point is anecdotal, but I have heard from quite skilled teachers that they've chosen now to include more explicit loving kindness or self-compassion practices, even into traditional practices, where that would be more about like bare attention or just building, you know, decentering or equanimity, that you have to, that the self-kindness is sort of like a solve, like when you do scrape your knees, you know, trying to figure out how to walk these new territories and use these new skills. That's what sort of takes the sting away and lets you kind of get on with it a bit, rather than if you have this sort of all or none thinking and it's like very performance outcome focused, you have, you did something wrong, it can really disrupt the pattern. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's whatever you need to do to keep trying to move forward and keep that sort of growth trajectory going, that seems like it's going to give people, you know, the best shot at improving their lot in life in terms of their well-being. So, I think we'll see. I think that more and more the research community is starting to think about, like, well, can you actually show evidence that people are doing more than just calming themselves down? Like, how do you show that they're becoming more pro-social? How do you show that they're actually becoming more engaged or responsible or becoming better citizens? And we're trying to get beyond just symptom relief now into actually testing some of the predictions made by this sort of mindfulness to meaning theory, that the real value is in the long-term payout as you change the type of life you're living. Mm-hmm. And even in our lab, we're trying to develop tasks, for instance, where you compete, you play the same game trying to win money for yourself versus winning money for a charity you say you care in, for instance. And so you say, of course, the charity is more important than your own pocket, but because does your behavior indicate that, right? Especially if the task is challenging or boring, and not that you don't still want to win money for yourself, but can we actually show evidence that people are reshaping some of their basic behavioral habits to indicate at least an equivalent regard for other things they say that are important in their lives.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. You'll have to keep us posted on these results. It sounds really interesting.
Yeah, hopefully the papers will be coming out in the next couple of years as we sort of churn through the data now as an intense period in the lab.
Cool. Mm-hmm. So we are coming up on the end of our time together. And if you don't mind, I would love to squeeze in that question about psychedelics, because I know that your lab is now into that a little bit. Paper came out about microdosing, and I believe there's some ongoing work there. How do psychedelics fit into all this?
Yeah, I think it's all about trying to change your mind for the better. The psychedelics provide another option. Sometimes you could look at it as a shortcut, or just another entry point into trying to have these sort of upward trajectories of growth and things like knowing your own mind and shaking up, you know, maladaptive patterns. And there's also, just like meditation, is a very long history, thousands of years of history of people using these practices to promote experiences like awe and self-transcendence and see themselves as something bigger than their normal, tightly kind of survival constrained way of knowing about the world, that have lasting ramifications even after the high of the drug has long since left the system. So I think there's a lot of potential there. I think the psychedelics movement right now is probably being driven mostly by market forces. Like, I think there's the same number of people who have kind of hippy dippy, you know, or at least more exploratory natures. It's not like there's, this generation is like 20% more hippie than the generation before, and that's why psychedelics are coming into the forefront. It's more that, like, wow, we're making like billions of dollars off of marijuana. What's next? Is really what I think. If you want to hear my jaded take on why it's becoming so permissible again, it's financial, but that doesn't mean that we can't ride those coattails a little bit of the private sector and try to do some good research to really have a clear-headed account on both the potentials to promote things like, you know, decentering insight, change and access to eudaimonic meanings and values through psychedelics, and at the same time be fair about it and say, you know, just as we're starting to discover that there are some dangers to intensive not that intensive, just to any meditation practice where you could trigger some sort of underlying vulnerability, you could introduce also mental health problems or other issues with psychedelics in a way that we really should be like cautiously optimistic about, right? That there's probably safe ways, because we know historically from over thousands of years, there are safe ways to benefit from psychedelics and to sort of have our eyes open and try to appreciate the risks and benefits. So our lab's just trying to wade through the layers and layers and layers of risk management and bureaucracy and oversight, and using a controlled substance for research and like a clinical trial. We're using microdosing as a sort of a slow burn way of trying to see the types of changes promoted by building up psychedelics in your system, as opposed to these sort of real higher, much higher acute, you know, insight doses that have really started to make it into mainstream scientific literature over the past decade. I think there's a handful of sites around the world that are trying to get started in this way, to see whether the types of insights you have either in a sort of slow building way as you take, you know, a tenth of an active dose in a microdosing context, and in other labs with these full doses where you have these profoundly different disorienting experiences and thoughts and meanings, as you really destabilize the default network temporarily and allow all these other connections into the default network to occur, which seems to be a property of things like LSD or psilocybin, like magic mushrooms, that you may be sort of from a bottom-up chemical, endowed way, doing a lot of the same things people are trying to do with intensive meditation practice in terms of the local mechanisms of change. So yeah, it's really exciting. And like I said, what I've started to do is think more about, like, how do we get people to build these capacities? And let's not be too precious about any one technique. We don't want people doing things that are unsafe. But at the same time, if someone's like, yeah, meditation really doesn't work for me, and I went on this mushroom trip and it changed my life, and now I can be present for my family, I'm not going to say, well, you didn't do meditation, so it's garbage, right? Like, my conclusion would be like, oh, it's cool, we should try to understand what's happening. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the holy grail for a lot of mental health research is, how do we even find ways of fitting people to the right access points, right? I think there's a consensus that we want people to be on these growth and insight trajectories. And there's really just like chaos in terms of how that happens. Everyone just wants people to do the thing that they were trained in and it worked for them. And a more mature clinical science is one, or a science of even health promotion rather than just illness prevention, is one where we try to say, like, who are you? Like, what do you care about? How does your mind work? Okay, then this might be the access point for you to continue growing. Like, and if we survive long enough to become that mature society, I imagine that will start becoming more codified. But right now, it's sort of the best we can do is at least be aware that there are these different access points. And again, like I was saying, mindfulness builds failure into the practice, build failure into the practice of getting your own practice, right? So like meditation would work for you. Try that. Have you tried doing exercise? Have you tried doing cognitive therapy? Have you tried psychedelics? Have you tried X? And let's have a bunch of things in our toolkit and hopefully find ways of matching people up into something that is safe, but is effective and hooks mm-hmm. them and gets them into this upward spiral instead of a downward spiral.
I'm curious about coming back to some of the mechanisms we talked about earlier, just the way you put it in terms of these, did you call it like an insight trajectory or whatever, where people just sort of get on this track of having more awareness of their habits and building skills to break free and then connecting with values. You know, cognitive therapy can do that and meditation can do that and psychedelics can do that. And there's probably a long list of other things that can do that. Mm-hmm. And we just need to find the right on-ramp for people. Yeah. And to push that a little bit further, would you say that the mechanisms are the same and it's just different tools? And would you say that's the case sort of neurobiologically, or are these just radically different approaches that bring about similar transformations in people?
Well, I think the mechanisms must be slightly different. Otherwise, they would all be the same access point. Mm-hmm. But I think the way I'm doing it, maybe just because it's the only way I can think about it, is I think the broad dynamic is fairly universal, right? And you can, I remember as an undergrad reading The Perennial Philosophy, which is a collection of like aphorisms that Aldous Huxley put together like in the 1920s, where he tries to make the case essentially by sampling from Western and Eastern philosophy that like we're all kind of up to the same thing historically as human beings when we start thinking about like our liberation from suffering or what it means to live like a good life. And so we're just trying to figure out ways of getting people on that track. I think now more than ever, the conversation about like, you know, what makes for a good life is so peripheral, so marginalized, that there's like a hunger for it, a yearning for it, and finding that. And so the local mechanism, hence your question, like what psilocybin does, for instance, like magic mushrooms to change a neural configuration, is that how that process unfolds is probably very different than what's happening when you're doing like a body scan in formal meditation at the sort of local mechanistic level. But the broader consequence of re-engaging with sensory exploration, whether it's because your brain can't help but do that because the filter is broken because you flooded psilocybin into your brain, or because you just made things so boring that the default network kind of spun down and just gave up for a while because there really was nothing to do and predict. You know, that those mechanisms might be different, but in the end, we're trying to get to that same place of like letting something new happen. Like how do we sneak in change when everything our brain is trying to do is make things like predictable? And do that in a way where the change that we allow in is then curated, so it's a positive kind of change that is the kind of change we want, and do it in a way that helps us have a sense of being connected to more than just our own local concerns, and something that's sustainable, that we're doing something bigger than ourselves that in some ways helps us even like counter the limits of our own mortality. These are sort of like very perennial human strivings that I think we're just developing a modern vocabulary around. It's just really exciting to be doing this kind of research, even though the day-to-day, like any job, is a lot of minutiae. Right. These are like the kind of big questions that really get me fired up. So yeah, I think it is a big, broad, common, or maybe even universal mechanism, but because every person is different and that the access points are going to be different, and the mechanisms by how those access points work are going to be quite different, but they should be feeding into a common dynamic of being able to have some control over the nature of stability and change in the mind, which are kind of constant. There's a constant tension there. Mm-hmm. And how do you get people to even consider walking these paths if they're not like a sort of philosophy and psychology nerd to begin with? And you know, like that's the question, right? Right. Yeah. Right. So yeah. Wow. And hopefully, yeah, someone tuning into a podcast here or there, maybe you're like, oh yeah, maybe I will think about that a little more today, and it can make a difference for them.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're fired up about these things, because I want you to keep doing this research and keep helping us clinicians and mindfulness teachers like get more and more clear about what we're actually doing and how to help people more efficiently. And you certainly got me fired up. I feel like I can talk to you every morning like this, and I'm so grateful for you taking the time. Thank you so much for joining.
Yeah, thank you so much for giving me a chance to ramble on for a bit, and hopefully some of it's meaningful for people. And yeah, we're all in this together. So let's see what good we can do while we're here.
All right, thank you again so much, Norm, and I'll be in touch with you again for part two of this conversation when some of that new data comes out.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, I have a lot of grad students trying to graduate in the next year or two, so there's going to be a lot of self-interested motivation to get these papers out in a way that hasn't happened in the past 4 or 5 years. So yeah, stay tuned.
All right, thanks a lot.
Cool. Okay, thanks, Joe.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more mind space, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.